Welcome to the Red Letter Christians podcast. Red Letter Christians gets our name from the Bibles that highlight the words of Jesus in red. And we're aspiring to live as if Jesus meant the stuff he said. We know that the loudest, most prominent voices representing Christianity in America haven't always been the most beautiful or the most faithful voices. And we know that the way we change the narrative is by changing the narrators. We are committed to amplifying the voices of people who are dedicated to Jesus and to justice. How much longer will
justice be? Hello, everybody. This is Shane Claiborne, and I'm so glad you're listening in. We got a half hour together here, and I am really excited. I kind of use this always as an excuse to catch up with friends and hear what's going on in people's lives, folks that I love and admire. And today, I especially have my good friend, John Wilson Hartgrove. Hey, buddy.
Hey, good to be with you and all your friends.
Well, there's so much going on, but I wanted to make sure, first of all, we'll catch up on everything, but you've got this real exciting thing going on at Yale with Reverend Barber, Bishop Reverend Barber, and I want to make sure folks know about it, because there's still time for people to join in and be a part of it, either in person, or I don't know if it's live streamed or what, but tell us what's going on, man.
For sure, yeah. This is the new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale. We started about a year ago, and in April 7 to 9, we're having what's really our first public offering. So sort of, you know, putting out the call for folks to come to New Haven and be part of the inaugural conference that the center is hosting. It's called What Are the Moral and Spiritual Issues of the 2024 Presidential Election? So lots to talk about there. But, you know my story. I, you know, grew up when, you know, white Baptist churches in the South, like the one I grew up in, were really being targeted by that day's version of the religious right, and got caught up in a kind of politics that, you know, had a very narrow set of moral issues that it directed people's attention to. And there's a lot of attention right now on the way that, you know, not just those folks who were doing it then, but others who've joined them since then have really built a movement of organizations that are promoting Christian nationalism in this country and religious nationalism around the world, frankly. And that's a lot of the reason why we think it's incredibly important to have public theology that's really rooted and grounded in scripture and in the broad Christian tradition, you know, in conversation with other religious traditions, and that really talks about the moral issues that are important to the prophets and to Jesus and, you know, to the stories at the heart of the Bible. So that, I think, resonates with all our red letter Christian friends and folks, you know, who've been trying to kind of figure out how Jesus got lost from so much of Christianity. But a lot of times, you know, I talk to a lot of people who are, you know, and I'm sure you do too, you know, thinking about deconstruction and trying to like break down all the things that have been wrong. And that's important work to do. But we're really trying to do constructive work here to say, you know, there are traditions that have really, you know, helped us see how people can be involved in public life in standing with folks who are poor, folks who are in need of health care, people who are fighting for living wages, you know, people who want to see policy that really is good for most people. Paul Wellstone used to say, everybody does better when everybody does better. That's good policy, but so often that's not what gets talked about as moral policy. So we're trying to have a space where we can rally around together to reframe that. So that's coming in April.
Yeah.
So
would love that, for you know, to I was join. Thinking of this, you and Bishop Reverend Barber wrote this book together, Reconstructing the Gospel, and the subtitle, I think it's Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion, right? And I was thinking this morning, John, and I was on the phone with Lisa Sharon Harper, and she did a really great job at contrasting the deconstruction movement from the decolonization movement. Hmm. And in one sense, like, it's kind of saying similar things to you, that there's folks that are doing a lot of work to deconstruct the kind of Christian nationalism and the white evangelicalism and stuff that they grew up with. But there's other groups of folks that they don't have that same construct, but it is about decolonizing and not allowing the gospel to get hijacked, right? And I don't know if you want to say more about like that constructive side, because I know you and Rev are both deeply embracing a beautiful version of our faith, as am I, despite the kind of distortions that we see of it. And it does allow a certain power to just let the kind of most toxic or weird versions of our faith take the whole Jesus movement and say this is all that it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the movements around the world to decolonize have been led by, of course, the people who were colonized, you know, the people who realized that the great good news of the empire wasn't good news for them. I think it can sometimes be harder for people who've been given some access and privilege in this world's empires to recognize that, you know, those systems are not great news for us either. And that was kind of the realization that I had to come to, that, you know, as a white straight man in this culture, you know, most of our kind of systems and cultures don't just affirm, but like privilege people like me. And that in itself isn't good for your soul. Mm-hmm. You know, Vincent Harding used to say to people like me, he'd say, you know, what kind of privilege is it really to be descended from somebody who claimed to own other people?
Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy.
So when I was wrestling through all that and was trying to figure out, well, like, what other way is there? That's when I met Reverend Barber. I was, you know, 16 years old. I had just paged in Senator Strom Thurmond's office in D.C. You know, I had gotten to know all these sort of, you know, religious right influencer types in D.C. and was in the, like, you know, club to wear my blue blazer and, you know, try to do my time and move on up. And here was somebody, you know, who was just as committed to Jesus, more committed to, I think, what Jesus was really about, but talking about Jesus just as much, and had a very different way of living out what that could mean in the world. And I think, you know, what was really good news to me is that, you know, so often I think in the way the story of faith gets told in the United States, that seems like an exception, like that's an exceptional thing. You know, Martin Luther King existed and he's such an exceptional hero, he gets his own day. You know, it's that kind of sense of, like, there's only a few people like this. And, you know, Reverend Barber helped me learn that, actually there's a tradition that's been there all along, and people who've practiced this faith and, you know, they haven't gotten a lot of the publishing deals. They haven't gotten a lot of TV time. You know, they don't have television ministries often, but there is a river, as the Psalms say, and it flows, and we can drink from it and join it. And that's what, you know, we've been trying to introduce people to who are, you know, in formation, who are studying for ministry at Yale Divinity School. And it's been really fun to be able to develop courses that, you know, introduce people to the people who were teaching abolition, you know, in the churches when, you know, when before abolitionism was really even enough of a movement to have support. I mean, these folks would go into a town two by two, like Jesus said, and, you know, they go around posting their own, you know, placards about their meeting that night, and, you know, might get 30 or 40 people in the room, and half the people who came to the room came to run them out of town, right? So they were often, you know, running for their lives the next day to carry the message somewhere else. I mean, that's it's amazing to think about how much of the goods that we just assume in this country have depended on people like that, who were very rooted and grounded in their faith and their discipleship and their commitment to Jesus, and it's what kept them going.
Yeah, and I was thinking of speaking of the collision of principalities and powers and the gospel in the world and colonization. The Yale Divinity School is built on the Winchester Estate, so you talk there about is, yeah. good yep. things coming out of the compost. There we go, man. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, literally got like Winchester Avenue there, right?
Oh, yeah.
The whole like gun plantation is there. Lord have mercy. So it was, it's now the Divinity School. And, you know, I think when we talk about politics, there's a lot of folks that are, you know, leaving institutional religion. They're disenchanted with the church. But there's also a lot of people that are pretty disenchanted with politics, especially right now. I mean, it feels like we're watching a train wreck this election. And I mean, you know, obviously Trump has sort of come to embody the seven deadly sins. So there's not many of us that are going to be defending that. But it's really difficult right now, I think, to face the reality that Biden and the Democratic Party has been really complicit with the suffering in Gaza and blocked the ceasefire resolution at the UN. And even like the Supreme Court going like, when is this ever going to end? Like, there's sort of like an awakening of the crisis in our democracy. So I'm sure like that's kind of what you're unpacking a little bit at this conference in April. But you want to say a little bit more about that? Why people?
Oh, absolutely. Moral voices have to be clear-eyed. If we listen to the prophets, both parties in these United States of America are in need of repentance. And the violence in Gaza that has had U.S. sponsorship. Let's just be clear, that's bipartisan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand why people are protesting Biden, but mm-hmm. But Republicans and Democrats have said that. But you know, I'll be clear that it was the failure of Democrats in the Senate in 22 that allowed the worst violence in this country to continue, which is, you know, the violence that kills 800 people every day. The fourth leading cause of death in this country is poverty. Mm-hmm. And with one vote, the Senate had a chance to bring 52 million people out of poverty by doing what the Democratic Party had said it would do in its platform. And, you know, the Republicans in the Senate hadn't committed to it, but the Democrats had. Mm-hmm. And it was a handful of Democrats who kept that from passing the Senate. So yes, there's plenty of critique to go around. But I mean, part of, I think, engaging in politics as, you know, people who are trying to be faithful to Jesus and to a moral center is recognizing that, you know, the kingdoms of this world are limited at best in their capacity to do good. And yet they can do good, and both by, you know, omission and commission, they can do a lot of evil. And so to whatever extent we have, you know, power in these places, and I think this is very much in Scripture, though there are not, you know, democracies in Scripture, it's clear throughout that the power that the prophets had within, you know, the monarchies that they existed in, they used that power to call the governments to cease injustice and to care for the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever the policy issue, we're called to do that. And that's what we're trying to put those traditions in conversation with the best policy research that exists, because that's a tool we have too, right? You know, what tools are available? If you do care about ending poverty, if you do care about, you know, making sure people have access to health insurance, if you do care about, guaranteeing equal protection under law in this country, what tools exist within the systems of government that we have in this place that can be used? And so we've got 28, 29 of, you know, the best theologians and biblical scholars that, you know, we've been in conversation with, alongside the best, you know, public health, you know, folks and people who do voting rights work and, you know, people who study economics and social policy, wages, union rights, those kind of things. So that's the kind of conversation that we're trying to facilitate at this gathering.
Yeah, and if y'all are just tuning in, the voice you've been hearing is Brother Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, dear friend and collaborator for a whole lot of years. I won't tell you how many, but his newest, one of the newest things he's involved with is together with Bishop William Barber at Yale. It's a new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy, and they're hosting a conference April 7th through the 9th. We've been really excited about that. Folks are joining in a lot of different ways. And I wonder, like, maybe give us some of the handholds for these issues one of the things that's been so helpful about the Poor People's Campaign is the five interlocking injustices. Dr. Martin Luther King talked about the triplets of evil, you know, the racism, materialism, and militarism. And in the Poor People's Campaign, we've talked about those five interlocking injustices that include also the distorted narrative and the ecological crisis, along with the others. So are those some of the frameworks for conversation? Or because I think there's a lot of people also listening from other countries to the show that, as we think of what it looks like to exercise our faith in public and to try to move policies so that they prioritize the things that we see in the gospel, that those are really helpful, the five interlocking injustices, right?
Yeah, I think that is a helpful framework. We're basing, our discernment about what issues matter on this biblical and moral principle. I mean, I think it runs through the Old and New Testament, this notion that God hears the cries of people who are suffering. And so if you want to know what the moral issues are in any place, in any age, you have to listen to who is crying out for justice. And, that's not just in any one given moment, but when you hear the same cries, year after year, and in some cases, decade after decade, I think those are the pressing issues. They may not be what makes it on the news. They may not be what any politician is talking about, but those are the true moral issues that I think the prophetic tradition has to care about. We know from lots of good research that for over four decades now, inequality in the United States has grown. And with that, the number of people who have struggled to get by has become nearly half of the country. We use a measure of poverty. So part of this is just a recognition that the government doesn't really measure poverty as it's experienced by Americans. We still use the OPM, the official poverty measure. It was developed by a good person working in the government over 50 years ago, who was trying to estimate what it means to be poor. And she figured at that time, which is basically true, that what it took to just survive in the country was to be able to have as income three times what it takes to eat, right? So that's how she figured it. We still use the same measure today, even though the cost of food stuffs since that time has maybe quadrupled, but the cost of, cost of housing, cost of transportation, cost of education is often, 40, 60 times what it was then. So we have a distorted view even of what it means to be poor. And that means that, a lot of people just aren't heard, they aren't seen. People are struggling to make it. I mean, you occasionally see a story about, the increase in homelessness even homeless numbers are just based on how many people can be counted by volunteers in each county on one night of the year. That's where we get our official numbers. And, that in no way measures the number of people who are, working at the Walmart, sleeping in their car, going to the, drive the Lyft gig or whatever afterwards. I mean, there's just a lot of people who are living on the edge. The best numbers we have suggest that 135 million people in the United States are functionally poor. And so that's a moral issue. And when it comes to policy, that has to do with what we allow people to get paid by corporations for their labor. That's wages issues. It has to do with the dramatic decline in union rights. In the four decades ago, 30% of Americans workers in America were members of unions. It's a third of that now, right? And when you don't have somebody advocating for you collectively over and against these corporate powers, we see what happens. So that's kind of our working definition of sort of what the prophetic tradition teaches us that moral issues are. It's those issues that people cry out about the injustice year after year, decade after decade. And if we listen to those voices and ask what policies could be put, you know, into place that could make a difference for those things, that's when we begin to get a framework for what moral policy could look like in public life. So that's what we'll be talking about at the conference.
Got a few minutes left, and I think you know, when Dr. King says that the church is not meant to be the servant of the state or the master of the state, but the church is meant to be the conscience of the state, and I think, you know, Reverend Barber, when he talked about being the defibrillator, you know, that wake America up and, you know, shock us back to love again. That conscience, it feels like, is really at stake in our country right now. I mean, I think a lot of folks are trying to navigate that in different ways. And, you know, I think of Brother Cornel West, who's running for president now. And I mean, he's been someone that I so deeply respect. We've marched with him. He's been on poor people campaign rallies. And everybody, I think a lot of folks are looking for something that resonates with them beyond just the kind of old stale rhetoric. I don't know if you want to, I'm not asking you to have a you know, Cornel West bumper sticker or anything, but I think there's a lot of folks that are looking for something new. You know, the two-party system, this polarization feels like it's just paralyzing us. And I remember there were some scholars at Harvard that said the only thing that the two parties have agreed on is the rules that would keep out a third party, you know, that would keep us stuck. I don't know if you want to say anything more about, like, how we get out of this. I mean, you know, there's a part of it that just feels like, you know, I don't falter or waver in my faith in Jesus, but I do kind of get exhausted of the two political options. And, and I mean, especially in this election, it just feels like really, really hard to get excited about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I completely agree with and affirm people who are dissatisfied with politics as it exists. I also know that to change political systems, you have to have power. And that requires power within whatever existing systems there are. So if you look historically in this country about, you know, how have moral movements built power, they've built it by having coalitions that have, you know, worked within both parties, frankly, to change what the priorities are. Now, I mean, given the wholesale capitulation of the Republican Party to this kind of MAGA extremism for the last few years, it's hard to know exactly what the future of that party will be. But parties have realigned, you know, many times in U.S. history. I'm from the South, you know, but the party's completely flipped down here 50, 60 years ago. So in terms of what they represented and who their base constituency was. So all that to say, parties can change, but only when they have to. And so I think from the perspective of trying to push the priorities of issues that impact people who are hurting, we have to build movements that demand that the people who are running for office pay attention to what the concerns of people are. And, you know, the civil rights movement, for example, very effectively did that and changed the Democratic Party and its priorities in the 1960s. I think
we run out of time, I just want to make sure that you give people a website or a way to, like, find out more about the conference. We'll keep talking for the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. You can learn more at publictheologyconference.com.
Well, that's a good website. Yeah, go there. And you'll also see a bunch of more stuff about it on the Red Letter Christians website. So it's been a powerful half hour. We're going to keep talking for the folks in the podcast. Always good to be with my brother, John and Wilson Hartgrove. And you can also join us every month for morning prayer on the first of each month. We do prayer from common prayer. I had to do it without you this month, and I did the singing. Okay.
All right.
On my own, brother. So thanks for listening in, y'all. Let's keep talking a little bit if you want about, because you're kind of mid-sentence. So yeah.
I mean, so I was just saying that movements have a power to change parties, and I would love for there to be 3, 4, 5 parties. I mean, in many ways that can create a more robust conversation, but that can only happen if a party within our current system has majority power in both sides of the Congress and the presidency. And I think the best hope for that right now is probably the Democratic Party. So
I think it was even New Zealand where they vote for the policies and the platform, right? And then later that group selects the person. They're like, mm-hmm. not as personality driven. They would never have a reality TV star or whatever. There's a resistance to that, the personality only. And they want it to be more about the morals and values and policies. So it almost feels like we need that kind of fresh imagination. So hopefully this Yale conference and what y'all are doing can stir it up.
There are really good folks working on sort of how to make democracy more robust at every level. If you don't know the work of Danielle Allen at Harvard, I mean, her work is really, really good. She's got a new book out called Justice by Means of Democracy. Maybe it's not that complicated. Maybe it's just Justice by Democracy. Anyway, that's the idea. Danielle Allen is her name. But she's had a project for some time just looking at sort of at every level. How can we have a more of a democratic practice? Because, I mean, people talk about like saving democracy as in making sure the next election actually, isn't stolen. And that certainly is important. But in some ways, like if you don't practice a muscle, it's not going to be able to work anyway. And in many ways, we don't practice democracy regularly in terms of people's everyday engagement with, the city, county, local governmental groups that shape the policy that impact a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, I think one last question, and then we can talk about anything else you want. But, years ago, our brother Tony Campolo, there's many great Campolo lines, but one of them is, marrying yourself, your faith to a political party is like mixing ice cream and horse manure. It doesn't do much damage to the manure, but it really messes up the ice cream. And I've heard Reverend Barber also say that a lot of these things are not about left and right. They're about right and wrong. But it does feel like, you've pointed out the Republican Party's in a real crisis. But some of these things like military spending, Biden has raised the budget of Trump. They transcend partisanship. And so I don't know if you have, I know the critiques of on the right, but are there concerns you have on the left about, the state of the Democratic Party right now or, some of the circles that we're in?
If you care about poverty, you have to challenge the Democratic Party's basic capitulence to, neoliberal economics, which is, just the idea that, if the companies have more money and if the companies have more freedom, that the economy will do better and then everybody will be better. That has not been true. But Democrats and Republicans have supported that.
Trickle up economics. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it just has not worked out. Militarism is a huge one that has been bipartisan for some time that has to be challenged. It's not just about the current situation in Gaza. I mean, that's we were in Iraq 20 some years ago now, and Sister Barbara Lee was the only person in Congress who voted against that war. She's still there, bless her heart. But Democrat, Republican, they all left her alone in that vote. She was the only one who voted against a very unjust war in that case. So sure, there are always going to be many issues on which, people who are trying to hold true to the moral center cannot line up with any party or politician. That's just the reality of, trying to, and frankly, let's be true, be honest about this too. There are always going to be, issues that we are blind to and that we miss in our context, which is why we always have to be listening to people as closely as we can, who are not in our situation. I've learned so much over the last few months from, our our Christian family in Gaza. You know, folks like we've talked to on here, Mitri Raheb and Munter Isaac and those folks who were really trying to teach us what the gospel looks like from their context. So you know, humans are limited. We're never going to get this all right. So we can't pledge our allegiance to party. We can't pledge our allegiance to, you know, any particular representative, but we can make choices. And I think we have to, because you James Baldwin said, you know, responsibility is never, you can never get rid of it. You can abdicate it, but you can't deny your responsibility. So to the wherever we are, what power we have to discern how to best use it for the good of our neighbors and our, you know, our world. And I think that's the challenge we face when we engage politically. And I think that's, you know, the situation we're in right now.
Yeah. You writing anything right now? Or is it top secret?
Oh, no. Reverend Barber and I have been writing a lot over the last few years, and have just finished a book that's coming out in June. It's called White Poverty.
Oh, right.
How exposing myths about race and class can reconstruct democracy. And it's all about really trying to get through some of these age-old myths that are used to divide the electorate in this country that has the potential to change things. I mean, he spends a lot of time these days teaching people just how much power poor people have to change the electorate, because low-income voters have participated at about 20% less, you know, frequently as higher-income folks, for good reasons. You know, people haven't felt like they had anybody to vote for. They haven't, you know, just haven't had time to get to the polls on Tuesday between their two or three jobs they're working. So we get that. But if poor and low-income, low-wage voters were mobilized around issues, we know that in every swing state, they make up many times the margin of victory. So this is the largest group of swing voters in the country, and nobody's talking to them. So you know, we've been really trying to say there's a potential here. If we want to have a movement to really shift things, there's a potential for poor folks to come together to do it. And, you know, that has a lot of Jesus in it.
Hallelujah.
The most political thing Jesus ever did was lead a poor people's march into Jerusalem.
All right. Well, I guess we celebrated 25 years of The Simple Way. That's where I am right now.
Hey, congratulations.
This year. Anything on the ground over there? Y'all been doing the Root the House for a while. What's new on the ground down there your way in Durham, North Carolina?
Well, it's a little over 20 years here now, and you know, things have changed a lot. The neighborhood's changed, the city's changed, but it's a gift to kind of stay connected with all of the, you know, people who've come and gone through the changes. So I was just here this past weekend, and there was a knock on the door, and a woman who lived here 10 years ago was there with a friend of hers, and, you know, just wanted to stop by and say hello. Yeah, that's a gift.
I love it.
Folks who are living here right now are people who lived here, you know, at other times in our past, but have come back around. And I don't know, it feels like it, you know, family can come and go and change, but it's good to be connected.
Yep. Well, all right, y'all. John and Wilson Hartgrove, thanks for, it's good to be together. We get to play together in the summer too. We head down to Tennessee and play on the water. By the way, got a little spot for us.
We got to set our dates.
Ready.
Yeah,
we do. Make sure y'all go check this out. The inaugural conference of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. Can people live stream it too, or is it more you got to be there in person? Is it going to be a little hybrid thing going, or what?
It's going to be in person, but if you're not able to come, do sign up for news, because we're going to try to kind of package some of what happens for after the fact to get it out to folks.
Sweet. All right, y'all. We'll talk to you soon. Love you. Thanks. Go to redletterchristians.org. Check it out. Join us if you haven't already. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Red Letter Christians podcast. Too often, Christians have used our faith as a ticket into heaven and a license to ignore the world we live in. But at Red Letter Christians, we believe our faith is not just about going to heaven when we die, but also about bringing heaven to earth while we live. For more information on Red Letter Christians and upcoming events, additional resources, you can go to the show notes or our website, redletterchristians.org. You can also support Red Letter Christians by giving a one-time donation or becoming a monthly sustainer. Just go to our website and click the red donate button. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and for being a part of this movement.